Good morning, everyone. Good morning. I'm doing the reading from the Message Bible, just because I really like that version. So every time I read, I seem to read from the Message version. And this is from John chapter 3, verses 1 to 18, even though the lectionary is 1 to 17. You can see I'm a bit of a rebel because I like to read the complete thing instead of stopping halfway through. So this is the story about Nicodemus coming to Jesus at night. There was a man of the Pharisee sect, Nicodemus, a prominent leader among the Jews. Late one night, he visited Jesus and said, "Rabbi, we all know you're a teacher straight from God. No one could do all the God-pointing, God-revealing acts you do if God weren't in it." Jesus said, "You're absolutely right. Take it from me. Unless a person is born from above, it is not possible to see what I'm pointing to God's kingdom." "How can anyone," said Nicodemus, "be born who has already been born and grown up? You can't re-enter your mother's womb and be born again. What are you saying with this born again from above talk?" Jesus said, "You're not listening. Let me say it again. Unless a person submits to this original creation, the wind hovering over the water creation, the invisible moving the visible, a baptism into a new life, it's not possible to enter God's kingdom. When you look at a baby, it's just that, a body you can look at and touch. But the person who takes shape within is formed by something you can't see or touch, the spirit, and becomes a living spirit. So don't be surprised when I tell you that you have to be born from above, out of this world, so to speak. You know well enough how the wind blows this way and that. You hear it rustling through the leaves and the trees, but you have no idea where it comes from or where it's headed next. That's the way it is with everyone born from above, by the wind of God, the Spirit of God." Nicodemus asked, "What do you mean by this? How does this happen?" And Jesus said, "You're a respected teacher of Israel, and you don't know these basics? Listen carefully. I'm speaking sober truth to you. I speak only of what I know by experience. I give witness only to what I have seen with my own eyes. There's nothing second-hand here, no hearsay. Yet, instead of facing the evidence and accepting it, you procrastinate with questions. If I tell you things that are plain as the hand before your face and you don't believe me, what use is there in telling me you of things you can't see, the things of God? No one has ever gone up into the presence of God except the one who came down from that presence, the Son of Man. In the same way that Moses lifted the serpent in the desert so people could have something to see and then believe, it is necessary for the Son of Man to be lifted up, and everyone who looks up to him, trusting and expectant, will gain a real life, eternal life. This is how much God loved the world. He gave his Son, his one and only Son. And this is why, so that no one need be destroyed. By believing in him, anyone can have a whole and lasting life. God didn't go to all the trouble of sending his Son merely to point an accusing finger, telling the world how bad it was. He came to help, to put the world right again. Anyone who trusts in him is acquitted. Anyone who refuses to trust him has long since been under the death sentence without knowing it. And why? Because of that person's failure to believe in the one-of-a-kind Son of God when introduced to him. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Yeah. Hey, quick word. Got asked the other day, someone said, why Oh, the scarf. It's kind of like, Palmy's not that cold. So just a little word, total side thing from it. So it's a stole, and two little things. A whole bunch could be said about it, but it doesn't need a whole bunch said. A couple of, why do I wear it? One, there's the personal thing for me. It's a reminder that, kind of like the yoke of Jesus to come in, and a stole reminds me of, it's a servant leadership. So when I put that out, it's partially not about any of you at all. It's for me to remember that call and that way of leadership that is under Jesus and as a servant. You think, well, okay, can't you do that internally? But there is a little bit for you as well, that when I wear the stole, it's not that you should think more of me. It's actually that this should point you to think it's not about me. It's also about Jesus. So you know, we're visual people, and this is a part of that storytelling and reminding. Another part of it, you'll see the color changes, that we don't tell time the way the world does. We're living in this great story of God. And so you see it change color. It's a visual reminder of that. So again, it's not the right way. It's not the, you know, the correct thing, but it's a part. So you'll notice today that we went from red to white. And so it's pretty got a bit more color on it than it ought, but it was a gift. We're going white because today is a feast day in the church, and today it's Trinity Sunday. And you know, most times we come and we celebrate the mighty acts of God in creation. And today we come, that also, we come, this feast is a day to celebrate a doctrine. Now before you all head for the exit and think, well, this is going to be utterly boring then, is that not what doctrine is? It's actually not. It's actually a look, and this is a feast day looking at what is the eternal reality? What is before anything else? And so it's really asking, well, let me ask a question to you to think about. What was before creation? What was before creation? What is the eternal existing reality? And the Trinity is going to give us the answer to that. And I'm going to give this much of it. I want to think about this is a beautiful part in John's Gospel. And Jesus says, he's speaking to the Father in this beautiful prayer in the garden before his death, before his crucifixion. He's praying, and he's praying to his Father, and he says, "You have loved me since before the world began." Think about that. What is before anything else? What is the eternal reality? It's love. But it's a particular love. Sometimes we all talk about it and say, well, God is love. We talk about love. It's almost become a cliche. But the doctrine of the Trinity shows us the character and the quality and the reality of that love. And that matters. We need to think about it because it informs who we are and how we're to express that love. So what I'm going to do today, just look at just three aspects of God's eternal love that the Trinity reveals. So think first, the Trinity reveals that the eternal love of God, it's relational. It's others-focused. When I think about this reality, the remarkable thing that before anything else, there was this love between the Father and the Son through the Spirit. I remember when Barnaby was born and getting up one morning, and he was a baby. I just remember standing there and holding Barnaby in my arms and just looking down. And I was just filled with this extraordinary love for this child. And as that moment, I remember God saying, he said, "Yeah, and that's how I feel about you." And it was an interesting thing. Like it's almost like it was so profound and so true, but I almost couldn't receive it. It's going to make me weep. This bit. It's like, why can't I see myself like that? Why can't I actually accept that? And yet at the heart of it, it's that sort of love, that gaze from one to the other, of just saying, you just cannot understand my love for you. And if I can show that or think that for my child, as imperfect as I am, And my goodness, imagine that this eternal reality sees you through that sort of eyes. Before anything else was, this eternal reality is this relational, others-focused love between the Father and the Son through the Spirit. A couple of things about that. You think about what it means to say Father. It's like a father and mother can't exist without relationship to the child. So this is an eternally existing reality. Like that relationship is baked in. It's not something that comes after. It's the eternal reality. And so when we say the creed, we say, God from God, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made, of one being with the Father, through whom all things were made. It's that incredible relational love. Just on that, this is a side, so much more could be said, but I'm going to name it. You can say, well, does that mean that God is he? I just want to name that. The church has never held that God is gendered. I just claim that, and it's tricky, I could go into it. God is spirit, and the second person of the Trinity takes on human flesh and to male. But the church has always held God is spirit. It's not gendered. If you look at the Greek, there's this tricky bits about it. But I just want to name that here without going further into it. And yet I also want to hold that reality that you look at Jesus' prayer. I think about 50 times he uses that term, Father. And so it's not nothing. But I just, we're not talking about three dudes and a bird. You know, we think about the Trinity. Often that's what we reduce it to. But it's this relational love. So just on that, we could talk about, well, God is creator, redeemer, sustainer of life. 100%, absolutely. But you notice what we've done with that? We've turned being into doing. So if you ask Barnaby, who's this guy here, he could say, well, he's, not Barnaby, we'll say Charlie, he's bottom wiper, put her out of the garbage, and book reader at nighttime. Those are all three things that are true. But they're doing. And I think by holding that language and with paradox about not being gender, it upholds the relationship. That at the heart, the eternal reality is this relational, others-focused love. You think about what that means if this doctrine of the Trinity, and you want to think, well, before anything was, what is the character of that love? And I think about, and this is a distinctive of Christianity. We don't hold it. You'll often, people say, oh, come on, Chris, it's all the same thing. And I get the spirit of conversations, but actually, no, it's distinct and it's different and it matters. You think about, if we think about God as an existing reality, not in Trinity, and so there's one person we say God is love, before anything else, what can that person love? What could that love look like? If that thing was the only thing existing, it would have to be an inward-focused love because the only thing to love would be oneself. Make sense? And yet, if this relationship is that awe, that God would have to somehow not be fully complete in that love. You'd have to create something to love, which is, again, is a very different nature of God. But to say, if the existing reality is this relational Trinitarian love of the Father and the Son through the Spirit, love in its pure essence is others-focused, relational, self-giving, and that's quite a different character and quality. So what do you think about that when we think about what does that mean for the church? What if we're called to love? That type of love, it's a relational love. Others-focused, not selfish love. Second thing, when we think, well, the Trinity, it reveals this eternal reality that this love of God, it's a love that's overflowing. It's multiplying. It can't be contained. If we think about some of the early thinkers in the church, they would talk about God almost as like being this fountain. You know, come thou fount of every blessing, if you go back to an old hymn. It's this love that is just so so extraordinary and so powerful. You think about like the Trinity is like this dance of love of others focused, but it's so powerful that it just simply must burst forth. It has to go out. It has to invite others into it. It needs to explode out like a fountain. I like to think of one of those chocolate fountains because it's that good. So if I was, you know, excuse to eat chocolate on Trinity Sunday. And it's this idea of this love. And what we see when we think about this before all else, well, think about creation. It is this explosive love that cannot be contained, that absolutely desires to multiply and go out and bursts forth almost in the song of creation. As you look at Genesis as this poem or song that explodes out in beauty and wonder and just incredible love that must go out and multiply. We see the sense of the Trinity saying, well, let us. So you get the sense of the one and the many already in that language. There's let us create humankind in our image. Because we just want more. We want that this love that we have for each other to explode and to go forth. So we want to create people in that relationship, for that relationship, to multiply that relationship, that that love would go out and multiply and be made known in the goodness of creation. And somewhere this is what we see in marriage. You get in the Trinity, you get the difference being held in unity. And so let us make this man and woman come both reflecting together the image of God and with this creative multiplying ability and capacity that our difference is held in unity. But it's this life-giving, overflowing love. So marriage can be a picture of that. Think about, well, so what does that mean for our community if we think about this eternal reality of a love that overflows and multiplies? Just to think about it, it's here in a vision part, isn't it? We're communities that are creating other communities. We're disciples that are creating other disciples. Always thinking about this living thing that's growing and going out and expressing itself in something that would grow. I also say when we think about it, we need to think about the goodness of creation, not just this people, individual things, and we're saved and then the rest doesn't matter, but actually if this is God and expressing this love and this beauty that pours out, then all of creation matters and reflects that. And so there's a stewardship comes into that as well, recognizing the goodness of that gift. Lastly, I think the reality, the doctrine of the Trinity, or a reflection on it, it reveals a reality that that love of God, this eternal love, it's a love that's pursuing and that it's redeeming and it's costly. And here's this picture. I don't have a Nerf gun, which is kind of a shame because that was awesome, eh? It's forgiven. But I do have this beautiful bunch of flowers that a loved one gave Cara, and these are beautiful, aren't they? And yet this is reality, as beautiful as they are cut off from the source of life. And so as much as we can affirm the beauty of this, say actually once it's been cut off from the source of life, it can look good for a season, it is there, but it faces perishing. It is, you can see it's partway there, might be sitting on the bench for a little bit longer, but it's cut off from the source of life, and so it's to perish. And that's what, when we take a look, if this is the eternal reality, this love of God that overflows, that wants others to know this relationship, to know this love and to multiply, the sad reality is that people turn from that love and from that source of love and life, and we're cut off. And so as we come under that power of death, of sin, and so we can be beautiful, we can be wonderful, and yet that's, and in the message reading this morning, as we heard that, there's that sense that it's not like God's trying to do something, that's the reality for someone who's rejected that love and that life as the source. It exists there. And so what we see as a result of that, that it's God's heart and this eternal love desires that none would perish. So it's a love that would come and pursue, that would look to redeem and to restore. And so we see, as in the beginning, God speaks and the Word and by the Spirit brings life. We see a new creation. The second person of the Trinity takes on human flesh. The Word becomes flesh, is filled with the Spirit. The Trinity is at work in new creation, shows us the fullness of that love. And in Jesus, we see the overcoming of all the opposite of love, the rejection, the hatred, the inhumanity, the mocking, the shame, experiences the reality of death. And yet in the resurrection, we see the power of this love that overcomes fear and death and brings about that power of new creation. And we think about the ascension a few weeks ago. More than that, in the ascension, what we're seeing is human nature, that God made flesh in human nature in the ascension. Humanity is raised up into that reality of the love of God and the Trinity. So a human nature, and this is Jesus' praying, this invitation that we could know and be a part and participate in this love of the Father and the Son through the Spirit. So a humanity is taken up into that relationship. The Spirit is poured out, that very power and love and personhood of God into our hearts, revealing God's love for us, that enables us to cry out, Abba, Father, that we could know this is a redeeming, costly love that would restore us and would desire for us to know that love. And that's how we see that at play. And so the invitation, as we think about in baptism, talk about my identity, my human, I identify in Christ. I die with Christ in that hope that so surely I shall rise with him. The Spirit is poured into my heart. We get those promises that we're children of God and that death doesn't get the last word. It's that born again through the Spirit that came through in that reading as well. So how does that impact the church? Well, if this is this eternal reality and the love of God that exists, then our love is called to be relational and others-focused. It's called to be multiplying and outgoing. But it's also, as children of God, to be about the family business, to be image-bearers of that love, to be part of that redeeming, reconciling, healing work in the world. I just wonder, have you encountered that love? Do you know God's love for you? Like I look down on Barnaby as that child. You know, that's how God sees you. And it might be good, but we cut off, or do we need that power of life so that death and sin doesn't get the final word? Just as surely as we share in Christ's death, so surely we will share in his resurrection. We can know that. We can live out of that. It can be a reality of that love and the power of that love in our lives, individually and together. So there we go, the doctrine of the Trinity. Not too dull and boring, was it? Actually, a cause for a feast in the church, a cause of actual great delight, that is the eternal reality that was before anything else and will be forever, so that what will remain is that love. So as a response to that, well, God can let you have that response. The Spirit is with you and in you, and I pray that you can encounter, if maybe that be a response for the first time. I'd love to speak with you about that, or Andrew, or anyone else would as well. But another way we often respond in the church is to stand up and to confess this faith. And on Trinity Sunday, a good opportunity maybe to confess the creed, the great faith of the church throughout history and throughout the world, that the majority will be confessing today. So let me invite you to stand with me. I'm going to ask our team to stand and confess. You notice the Trinitarian structure that we're praying and confessing our faith in this morning.